Greetings, my name is Sunny Brock, and I'd like to welcome you to this TechNet session on Internet Information Services 7.0 Performance Optimization. In this session, we will discuss how to tune a web server for speed and efficiency, from the hosting environment to specific configuration settings for various high-usage scenarios. Internet Information Services 7.0, which I will refer to as IIS7 for the remainder of this session, is the latest version of Microsoft's web server and is included in Microsoft Windows Server 2008. We will review the integrated pipeline architecture of IIS7 and how that impacts performance. Then, we will discuss how to best configure the environment, including hardware, network, and operating system, for optimum performance. We will take a look at how IIS7 handles ASP.NET applications and then discuss special tuning considerations. We'll discuss some best practices for managing worker processes and application pools, and we'll take a look at some tips and tricks for hosting managed applications. We'll also take an in-depth look at IIS7 output caching, which allows caching of semi-dynamic content to further improve throughput on hosted applications. Whether a web server relies on remote storage, SQL Server databases, Active Directory directory service, or other integrated pieces, there are further optimizations that can be made to best support a high-performance web solution. We'll talk about some common scenarios and take a closer look at how to tune remote storage for IIS7. Windows Server 2008 and IIS7 include some tools that make it easier to monitor performance. Using these tools, we will demonstrate how to measure performance and identify areas of optimization with network monitor and tracing. As with most TechNet sessions, some prior experience of Microsoft technologies or similar technologies is always helpful. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or other versions of Microsoft products we may not spend time on. To assist you, we have listed the areas that it may be helpful to be familiar with, either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. Experience with previous versions of Microsoft Windows Server and website hosting using IIS 6 will be helpful as we discuss the changes to IIS 7 and how they impact performance. In addition, you should be familiar with hosting ASP.NET applications and how serving dynamic versus static content plays into optimization scenarios. To cover the topics mentioned earlier and keep the session flow going, we have divided the session up into the following agenda items. We'll start this session by reviewing the new IIS 7 architecture with regards to performance, and then we'll take a look at some environmental configuration options. Next, we'll quickly review ASP.NET applications, and we'll discuss how to tune IIS 7 for the best performance with dynamic and semi-dynamic content, including using the new output caching feature. Then, we'll talk about some scenarios where network storage solutions, SQL Server databases, and other components are involved, and discuss how to optimize the throughput of the web solution as a whole. Finally, we will take a look at some of the tools provided in Windows Server 2008 that can help measure performance and diagnose optimization issues. For IT professionals, IIS 7 is a secure, reliable, and easy-to-manage web server. The customizable installation of IIS 7 ensures that administrators can minimize the attack surface, patching requirements, and memory footprint of their web infrastructure. For web hosters, IIS 7 is a cost-effective, more scalable web server for delivering reliable web hosting to a broader set of customers. IIS 7 lowers costs by providing a new, scalable shared hosting architecture, which is capable of hosting thousands of websites on a single IIS 7 server without sacrificing isolation or reliability. Let's review some of the key architectural changes in Windows Server 2008 and IIS 7 that impact performance. Server Core is an installation option built into Windows Server 2008 that omits graphical services and most libraries in favor of a stripped-down, command-line-driven system. During installation, Server Core is set up so that the server performs one of a few predefined roles. Although not available in the beta timeframe, one of the roles of Server Core in the Windows Server 2008 release will be IIS. Typically, a Server Core-based server is designed to be administered remotely. It can either be a separate computer or a small footprint virtual server. In addition to a stripped-down operating system, IIS itself has been completely modularized, allowing a minimal installation of only the necessary components needed to support a particular web application. IIS 7 is made up of more than 40 separate feature modules. Only half of the modules are installed by default, and administrators can selectively install or remove any feature modules that they choose. The IIS 7 core web server includes some fundamental changes from IIS 6 in the way that requests are handled. For example, both native and managed code can be processed, and is by default, through a single request pipeline. As previously mentioned, the IIS 7 request processing pipeline enables administrators to add or remove modules depending on their needs. Developers can also write custom modules to augment or even replace functionality, allowing a highly optimized custom solution to be created. The map path algorithm in IIS is responsible for mapping a URL to a physical path. For example, http://www.contoso.com/index.htm might map to c:/inetpub/www.root/index.htm. The new algorithm uses a streamlined lookup and performs better than IIS 6. Another performance optimization batches the execution of managed requests before switching to the managed context. Context switches between managed and unmanaged code are expensive to performance, so batching managed requests and processing them while staying in managed mode effectively increases the number of requests that can be processed and overall throughput. A significant new feature in IIS 7 is in-process configuration. An entirely new configuration system has been written for IIS 7 that loads configuration files, similar to Apache's htaccess files, and manages them in a cache. The new configuration cache consumes significantly less memory. Static compression allows a compressed copy of static files to be sent to a client browser if the browser is compression-enabled. The improved static compression in IIS 7 reduces the processor cost and memory requirements of using static compression. Before we consider how to make changes to impact performance, let's take a look at the kinds of traffic and expected performance we can get from a web server. Creating and maintaining a website involves using hardware, software, and network bandwidth to manage network traffic. Servers send out pages in response to requests. In order to issue a request, a browser first establishes a Transmission Control Protocol, TCP, connection with the server, and then sends the request through the connection. Network traffic, as the term applies to web servers, is the mixture of incoming requests and outgoing responses. Data traveling on a network is split into packets. In addition to the data that it carries, each packet includes about 20 bytes of header information and other network protocol information. This extra information is known as overhead. Most incoming HTTP requests are small. A typical request, for example, get http://www.contoso.com/default.asp, including the TCP/IP overhead, consists of no more than a few hundred bytes as it travels across the network. A server that displays a static HTML text-only page of 5 kilobytes can generate 6,920 bytes of network traffic. The TCP connection uses approximately 180 bytes, and the GET request is about 256 bytes. The 5 kilobyte HTML page itself is 5,120 bytes, and the protocol overhead to transmit the page is another 1,364 bytes. Multiplying by 8, we get a total of 55,360 bits for this 5 kilobyte page. A T1 line can transmit 1.536 megabits per second. Dividing bits per second by bits per page, we can estimate a maximum transmission rate of just under 26 pages per second. For this small, text-only page, we can estimate the estimated page delivery rate for several types of network interfaces. At the low end, a 28.8 modem connection can only serve about half a page a second. A DS3 T3 line can serve about 760 pages. A 1 gigabit Ethernet connection on an intranet can serve up to 13,600 pages under the best conditions. If you add a small graphic to the 5 kilobyte page, the results are considerably different. An image in the form of a JPEG file that appears on screen as a 1x2-inch rectangle takes up about as much disk space as the original test file. Adding one such image to each page nearly doubles the average page size and also the number of requests that are needed. This increased size reduces the number of pages that the server can send to the internet on a DS1T1 line to a maximum of about 15 pages per second, regardless of how fast the server itself runs. If a page contains several images, if the images are relatively large, or if the page contains multimedia content, the page can take much longer to download. You can often find simple solutions for improving download time, such as consolidating, removing, sizing down, compressing images, or converting images to a more compact graphics format. Connecting to the network by using a fast interface can also improve performance for the server, but not necessarily for the client. A site that serves primarily static HTML pages, especially pages with a simple structure, is likely to run out of network bandwidth before it runs out of processing power. In contrast, a site that performs a lot of dynamic page generation, or that acts as a transaction or database server, uses more processor power cycles and creates bottlenecks in its processor memory, or disk, or network. In Windows Server 2008, many of the key performance parameters of the network layer have already been addressed and don't require a lot of intervention to gain high throughput. Let's take a look at these areas and discuss how to make sure that the network is performing optimally. The server CPU can spend a lot of time on mundane tasks related to processing the TCP traffic. This can be alleviated by using a network interface card, NIC, that supports TCP offload. Make sure that the latest drivers for Windows Server are installed for the network card to take advantage of offload features. By offloading TCP processing to the network card, the CPU load can be reduced by up to 75% on heavy network load conditions. Several NICs allow the configuration of resources by the administrator. Receive buffers and send buffers are among the parameters that may be set. Be aware that some NICs actively manage their resources, and there is no need to set parameters. High rates of interrupts from network adapters can reduce performance. Some NICs expose buffer coalescing parameters, sometimes separately for send and receive buffers, for control over interrupt moderation. It is important to consider these when the NIC does not perform adaptive interrupt moderation. Be aware that oversizing coalesce buffers may introduce latency. In previous versions of Windows, the TCP receive window parameter was limited by default. A common change for broadband performance was to increase this setting in the registry. However, the best setting depends on the connection and latency. There was no one setting that fit all scenarios. In the new TCP/IP stack in Windows Vista and Windows Server 2008, the TCP receive window is automatically adjusted for each connection over time. Window scaling, RFC 1323, is enabled by default with a scale factor of 8 kb. No additional traffic is generated for automatic tuning. The scaling is based on real-time bandwidth and delay estimates. The benefit will vary based on spare capacity, with higher spare bandwidth seeing a greater benefit. In Microsoft IT deployment, throughput on file copies overseas improved by 10 times, and large file copies between the Bay Area and Seattle were able to take full advantage of a dedicated 1 gigabit connection, and throughput improved by 40 times after deploying Windows Server 2008. The congestion mechanism in the TCP protocol is limited when dealing with high bandwidth connections. The sending rate is cut dramatically when packets are lost, and the sending rate is increased very slowly. To maintain a full load on a 1 gigabit connection with 100 millisecond latency, there must be less than one packet per 83,000 lost. Compound TCP solves this problem by using the delay information to detect latency and rapidly speed up the sending rate without causing losses. NTT TCP is an industry standard tool used to measure network performance. It consists of two executable programs, NTT TCPR XE and NTT CPRS XE, which are configured to send and receive data. It helps to measure network driver performance and throughput on different network topologies and hardware setups. It provides a multi-threaded asynchronous performance benchmark for measuring achievable data transfer rate on an existing network setup. NTT TCP is available for download as part of the Windows Device Driver Development Kit, DDK. It can be very difficult to diagnose performance issues with the network. In Windows Server 2008, Microsoft has implemented extended TCP statistics support in the TCP/IP stack. The statistics can be enabled on a per-connection basis to measure real-time network performance. The data can be logged or utilized by any network application. TCP Analyzer, a tool which is part of the Windows Server 2008 SDK, is a graphical tool which displays the selected extended TCP statistics. It can be used to automatically infer performance bottlenecks. We'll take a look at this tool later in the session. Considering the new auto-tuning features of the network, it is especially important to begin benchmarking using the default settings before making any changes. Always run both long and short benchmark passes, and make sure to give full scenario coverage to see the best results. In our demonstrations, we will use the Web Capacity Analysis Tool, WCAT, also referred to as WebCAT, which is available in the IIS6 Resource Kit Tools on Microsoft.com. Once the default settings have been benchmarked, proceed by backing up the registry and configuration files before making any changes. Also, recycle the application pools after each run to empty the caches so that each benchmark is run from the same starting point. Change one setting at a time to ensure a clear picture of how that setting impacts performance. Run a full benchmark pass with the new setting. Make sure to monitor system resources and look for bottlenecks. After each run, analyze results against base configuration metrics and previous runs. Keep in mind that tuning can reveal underlying issues. For example, an application with a memory leak may fail much faster because the throughput to the application has increased. Decide whether to keep the new setting or revert to previous settings. Document changes and findings, and restore previous settings if necessary. Before making other changes, make sure that Windows Server 2008 is best configured for processing priority and memory. We'll discuss the optimum advanced performance settings and virtual memory in a demonstration later in the session. Also, consider stopping unnecessary services. Because each service consumes and creates threads that take up processing power and memory resources, consider stopping services if they are not required by the web application. Here are some services that might not be needed. Print services, Spooler, FTP publishing, SMTP service, indexing service, message queuing, simple TCP/IP services, SNMP, Telnet, telephony, RIP listener. Consider splitting applications to separate servers according to services required. For example, it may be wise to have a dedicated FTP server with content replicated to the publishing directory rather than sharing the web server. In today's high-bandwidth networking scenarios, disk access can become a bottleneck in moving large amounts of data quickly. Use as many spindles as possible to ensure throughput. Use separate physical disks for Windows system files, IIS INET pub directory, and IIS logs. Dedicated drives will also help separate tasks and prevent I/O bottlenecks. We'll also discuss some special considerations for using Storage Area Network, SANs, later in the session. Use Disk Defragmenter to defragment and reorganize all NTFS partitions after all products and updates have been installed. Run the Defragmenter tool on a regular basis by using Task Scheduler to schedule during off-peak hours. As we've discussed, there are many things to consider when benchmarking and optimizing the network layer. With peak processing and I/O subsystem throughput, we can more accurately assess the network. In a web farm, it is highly recommended to split network traffic from the internet to the backend server by having two separate network cards. We'll go through some of the network tuning options later in the demonstration. Finally, tune IIS Core and the ASP.NET settings for best performance given the applications. Streamline the applications themselves and trim content. We'll discuss this in more detail later in the session. Let's take a look at the environment we'll be using for today's demonstrations. We're using two Windows Server 2008 computers in our demonstrations. One server, CDC01, is running Active Directory domain services and DNS for the contoso.com domain in Seattle. Another server, CWeb01, is running the web server edition of Windows Server 2008. We also have a third server running Windows Unified Storage Server 2003, configured to provide a virtual storage area network. Let's take a look at some of the high performance settings in Windows Server 2008. In this demonstration, we'll configure the server to prioritize the web server's resources. We'll look at the options for offloading TCP processing to the network card, and we'll see automatic tuning in action. Because IIS relies on high server load, we're first going to set the server's performance settings. These settings can be found on the Advanced tab of System Properties. If we click Settings, we can change the performance options. The first tab controls visual effects. Although this setting only applies to the desktop and user interface of our server, we'll minimize the impact by choosing Adjust for Best Performance. Because we are working with the web server edition of Windows Server 2008, the setting to prioritize background services has already been set. We want to make sure that this is always the case for the best performance of IIS. Let's optimize the virtual memory. When a server is highly stressed reading and writing from disk, it makes sense to optimize the paging file settings manually. When we manually set the paging file to a static size, Windows will not spend excessive time resizing the file. To set the paging file to a static size, set the initial size and maximum size to the same value. Use the recommended paging file size value to ensure that the server won't run out of virtual memory. It is also recommended to set up a paging file on each locally connected physical drive. If the web server only has one drive, consider adding additional physical drives to maximize reading and writing throughput and to separate processes. We'll see other places to utilize the secondary drives later. When multiple paging files are set up on separate disks, Windows will optimize performance by writing to the least active drive. We can further optimize performance by disabling the paging file on the system disk, usually C. However, keep in mind that the paging file is necessary for system dumps that can only be written to the boot drive. So if you're concerned about stability or troubleshooting, you may want to leave the paging file in place on the boot drive until you're very certain that the system is stable. When we change the paging file settings, we're prompted to restart the computer. We're not going to do that yet. We can also increase the speed of reading and writing to the disks by enabling a setting on the disk drives. To do this, we'll open Device Manager and find the disk drive entries. Let's open the properties for the first disk drive. The setting for enabling advanced performance is on the Policies tab. This setting will enable an advanced disk caching that has better performance than the standard write caching. However, the possibility of data loss is greater in case of sudden system failure because more data is cached and may not be written to the disk. Since we are assuming that our IIS server sits in a hosting environment and we plan to connect it to an uninterruptible power supply, this shouldn't be an issue. We should repeat this setting for each of the disk drives listed, but that would take too much time for the demonstration. Depending on the network card, we may be able to offload some of the TCP processing to the network card to alleviate some of the load on the CPU. These driver-specific settings can be found on the Advanced tab of the Properties for the network device. Some network cards are capable of moderating how frequently they interrupt the host processors to indicate network activity, or its completion. Some NICs are also capable of making such decisions in an adaptive manner, taking into account network and host processor load. Increasing the receive buffers is also recommended. We need to keep these settings at default for now, so we'll go ahead and cancel. It's worth noting that many newer network cards can also handle processing of the entire TCP stack. The settings for enabling this capability can also be found on this Properties tab for those devices. In previous versions of Windows, it was common to adjust settings in the registry, such as the TCP receive window size, to improve performance on high bandwidth connections. In Windows Server 2008, the operating system takes care of tuning these settings for you based on the current connection. Let's take a look at this in action. We're going to use the Performance and Reliability Monitor in Windows Server 2008 to monitor the network activity during our test. We'll go into more detail about this utility later. We're using a network emulation tool to create simulated 100 millisecond latency for our test. This will give us a simulated internet experience. Our first test sends a file to a Windows Server 2003 computer. Since that operating system does not support auto-tuning, we should see the same performance as between a Windows XP client and a Windows Server 2003 server. We can see that the network throughput is going up and down, but pretty much peaks at the same rate. The scale for this window is at 10 megabits, throughput being the max. We're getting a maximum of 4% network utilization. The batch file loops the same large file over and over, so we need to use Ctrl-C to break out of it. Now let's try sending the file to another Windows Server 2008 server. Because Windows Vista also supports auto-tuning, we should see the same performance as between a Windows Vista client and Windows Server 2008 server. To show the true capacity of the improved network bandwidth, let's open a second command window and run another copy of the batch file. Notice that our bandwidth ramps up over time, and now the network monitor display has resized itself to 100 megabits throughput as the maximum. We're now getting over 50% network utilization at the peaks. We'll close the reliability and performance monitor for now. We'll also turn off the latency simulation before we continue. We've reviewed the new architecture in IIS 7 and Windows Server 2008, and we've taken a look at some of the high-performance settings for the network. Next, we'll dig deeper into ASP.NET, how the IIS 7 pipeline has changed, and how to get the best performance out of applications. Active Server Pages, ASP, are web pages that are created on the fly by an application running on the web server. An ASP.NET web application, in its simplest form, consists of a directory made available by means of HTTP, using the IIS administration tool, or through the web sharing tab of a folder's properties dialog box, or by creating a web application project in VisualStudio.NET, and at least one ASP.NET page designated by the .aspx file extension. This file, or files, typically contains a mix of HTML and server-side code. The HTML and server-side code combine to create the final output of the page, typically consisting of HTML markup that is sent to the client browser. The key to understanding how ASP.NET web applications work is understanding that the code in a script run at server block, or a render block, is executed on the server after the client requests the page, but before the output of the page request is sent to the client browser. This allows developers to decide, based on the code they write and the input received from the user, just what output is actually sent to the browser, either directly or by manipulating controls. It also allows additional functionality, such as server-side state management, to be provided to these applications. Besides the containing directory and ASP.NET files, an ASP.NET web application may also contain configuration files, web.config, user control files, .ascx, and an application settings file, global.asax, as well as code behind, assembly, and class files that provide additional functionality to the application. The other type of application available to ASP.NET app developers is the ASP.NET web service. Like ASP.NET web applications, there are a number of terms floating around for this type of application. A web service is an application that exposes programmatic functionality to clients over the internet or an intranet using the underlying plumbing of a W3C standard called SOAP. In simple terms, it can be seen as a simple function call across the internet. Unlike an ASP.NET page, a web service typically does not contain HTML, but consists solely of server-side code. A basic ASP.NET web service consists of a directory made available via HTTP and at least one web service file, designated by the .asmx file extension. The methods to be exposed by the web service carry the web method attribute. Note that the syntax of the web method attribute varies depending on the language used. In classic ASP, there was really only one type of application, one in which a client accessed a page with the .asp extension, and in which that page, either through embedded VBScript or JScript, or through script in combination with components built on Microsoft's COM standard, returned HTML to the browser to form the user interface with which the client would interact. Clients typically interacted with the application only through this user interface and did not have the option of creating their own alternative interface to the functionality exposed by the application. ASP.NET handling in IIS 7 has been greatly improved. IIS 7 can be configured to serve ASP.NET and content in two modes. In classic mode, IIS 7 serves ASP.NET content in the same manner as IIS 6. In IIS 6 and previous releases, ASP.NET was implemented as an IIS ISAPI extension. A request to an ASP.NET content type would first be processed by IIS and then forwarded to the ASP.NET ISAPI DLL, which hosted the ASP.NET request pipeline and page framework. Requests to non-ASP.NET content, such as ASP pages or static files, will be processed by IIS or other ISAPI extensions and were not visible to ASP.NET. The major limitation of this model is the fact that services provided by ASP.NET modules and custom ASP.NET application code was not available to non-ASP.NET requests. In addition, ASP.NET modules were unable to affect certain parts of IIS request processing that occurred before and after the ASP.NET execution path. In IIS 7, the ASP.NET request processing pipeline overlays the IIS pipeline directly, essentially providing a wrapper over it instead of plugging into it. A request arriving for any content type is processed by IIS, with both native IIS modules and ASP.NET modules being able to provide request processing in all stages. This enables services provided by ASP.NET modules, like forms authentication or output cache, to be used for requests to ASP pages, PHP pages, static files, and so on. The ability to plug directly into the server pipeline allows ASP.NET modules to replace, run before, or run after any IIS functionality. This enables, for example, a custom ASP.NET basic authentication module written to use the membership service and SQL Server user database to replace the built-in IIS basic authentication feature that works only with Windows accounts. In addition, the expanded ASP.NET APIs take advantage of direct integration to enable more request processing tasks. For example, ASP.NET modules can modify request headers before other components process the request, inserting an accept language header before ASP applications execute in order to force localized content to be sent back to the client based on user preference. Because of the runtime integration, IIS and ASP.NET can use the same configuration for enabling and ordering server modules and configuring handler mappings. Other unified functionality includes tracing, custom errors, and output caching. Better ASP.NET integration in IIS 7 both enhances existing applications and allows new applications to take better advantage of ASP.NET features in new ways. ASP.NET services can be used for all content types. In the past, ASP.NET functionality such as forms authentication, roles, URL authorization, and output caching were only available to ASP.NET content types, ASPX pages, for example. Static files, ASP pages, and other content types could not benefit from these services. In IIS 7, all ASP.NET services can be provided uniformly to all content. For example, you can protect all of your web content, including images and ASP pages, with your existing ASP.NET 2.0 access control solution built on ASP.NET forms authentication, membership, and login controls. Fully extend IIS with ASP.NET. Previous versions of IIS frequently required server extensibility to be developed using the native ISAPI filter or extension extensibility mode due to the runtime limitations of ASP.NET. IIS 7 allows ASP.NET modules to plug in directly into the server pipeline with the same runtime fidelity as modules developed with the native C++ server API. ASP.NET modules can execute in all runtime stages of the request processing pipeline and can be executed in any order with respect to native modules. The ASP.NET API has also been expanded to allow more control over request processing than was previously possible. Tighter ASP.NET integration also allows many of the features between IIS and ASP.NET to be unified. IIS 7 features unified configuration for IIS and ASP.NET modules and handlers. Many other features, including custom errors and tracing, have been unified to allow better management and cohesive application design. By enabling different modules, the server can be configured to provide the services required by the applications on the server. In this demonstration, we will review the server configuration and the set of modules loaded on the server by default. Then we will remove all modules to strip the server down to its minimal configuration and examine the effect on its footprint. Next, we will build a custom server by incrementally adding modules to support a specific scenario. As we've discussed, IIS 7 implements a modular architecture where virtually all of the server features are modular components. We'll examine how these modules are loaded. First, let's back up the server configuration so that we can restore it later. To do this, run the app command add backup command from a command prompt running as administrator. We'll call our backup initial. The main server configuration is contained in the application host.config file. This file is located in the IIS 7 configuration folder, Windows, System32, INET Serve, Config. Let's make a backup copy of this file before we proceed. If we open the application host.config file in Notepad, we can scroll down to the System Web Server section, which is where we will find the list of default modules. The Global Modules section, which can only be configured on the server level, contains the modules loaded by each server worker process. Each entry configures a module with a specific name and the DLL that implements the functionality of that module. For example, here is the static file handler module, static.dll. The Modules section, which can be configured at the server or application level, specifies which of the modules loaded in the Global Modules section are enabled for a particular application. For the most part, we can see that this section lists the names of the modules we saw in the Global Modules section, enabling them by default for all apps. We also see a few extra items at the end of the list. These are managed modules developed using the ASP.NET extensibility module. The Handler section, which can be configured at the server, application, or URL level, specifies how requests are handled. Modules typically participate in each and every request, whereas handlers only get requests for a particular URL. An example of a module is the compression module. The compression module looks at each response and compresses it if required. The ASP.NET page handler is an example of a handler. It receives only requests that are mapped to it. In this case, requests that have the extension .aspx. The handler's list defines the mappings between a request based on the URL and a verb and a handling module that will be used to process this request. There is also some extra information that is used to configure each mapping, which we will not be focusing on during this demonstration. In the previous task, we examined the default list of components loaded by the server, which contained 35 modules that provided various services ranging from compression to static file serving. Each of the components loaded in the server has an impact on the server footprint, its attack surface area, runtime performance, and of course, the enabled feature set. In Internet Explorer, we'll enter the URL localhost iasstart.htm. This will start the server application pool and serve the iasstart.htm document. Now let's close Internet Explorer and take a look at the server footprint. We'll use Task Manager to take a look at the processes that are running. Note the size of the W3WPXE server worker process. It reports about 4 megabytes. Now let's take a look at the DLLs that are loaded by the worker process. We can use the task list command with the M switch to display the modules. We can see that there are over 70 modules loaded by default. Most of them are located in the InetServe folder. Many of these are module DLLs we saw in the first task when looking at the global modules section of the config file, and a few others that support the .NET framework and the server runtime itself. Before we build our own custom server with just the functionality we require in the next task, let's build the world's fastest, smallest, and most secure web server by removing all the modules and running the empty server. Now we'll remove all of the modules so that we only have an empty global modules definition. Now we'll do the same thing for the handlers and module sections. Let's save the config file and reload the local web page. We don't get the welcome page this time, and there's an exclamation next to the status. That's because no handler is registered to serve the resource we requested. Now let's go back into Task Manager and take a look at the worker process. We can see that it's much smaller. Let's go back to the command line and look at the modules by the worker process now. Only 50 DLLs are loaded, as compared to 70+. This is indicative of the server not loading any of the module DLLs, which directly and indirectly accounted for the DLL count difference. Not only are the services disabled on the server, but also no code for these features is even loaded in the process. After optimization, the DLL count of the empty server will be significantly lower. In the previous task, we stripped down the server to the minimal configuration, with only the core server engine running and no additional modules loaded. Now we will build the custom server to be used as web file server on a corporate network. we'll open the backup config file that we saved earlier. First, we'll enable the server to serve static files. In the previous task, we stripped down the server by removing all of the modules it was running. In this state, the server always returns empty 401 error responses to all requests, as no modules are loaded to provide any kind of request processing whatsoever. We will copy the lines that load the static file handler module, which is responsible for serving requests for static files, and the anonymous authentication module, which produces a default authentication token for the request. Now we'll copy those lines back into our empty global modules section in our stripped down config file. Now we need to go down to the modules section and enable these modules for the default website. We'll add one line for the anonymous authentication module and one for the static file module. Since these lines are short, it's faster to just type them in. Now we have to tell the web server what to do with the request. We'll add a handler to the handler section. We'll call this handler static file. Because this web server is going to be dedicated to static files, we'll set the path property to star for this handler so that all requests for any file are handled by the static file. We only need to handle GET and HEAD requests. For the modules property, we're only specifying the static file module, and then we'll set the rest of the properties for resource type and read access. Now let's go back to Internet Explorer and try to load the start page again. This time, it should come up, and it should be extremely fast because the server is only dealing with static files with only one choice of handlers and two modules loaded. We've explored the componentized nature of the server, examined the IIS features that are provided out of the box, and seen how to build a custom web server with just the services to serve static files. You can use the same approach to just load the services and modules that you need for any web solution. Before we continue, we will undo the change to the server configuration. Since we created a backup earlier, we can restore it by running the apt command restore backup initial command from the command line. There are some tips and tricks to getting the best performance from ASP.NET applications. For more flexible command line administration, IIS 7 offers the apt-command-exe command line tool. This tool provides a comprehensive set of management functionality and better support for bulk operations than the UI. This powerful utility makes it easy to read and write configuration, access site and application pool state information, and perform almost any other management task, all from the command prompt. With apt-command-exe, you can create and configure sites, apps, application pools, and virtual directories. You can start and stop sites, recycle application pools, list running worker processes, examine currently executing requests, and search failed event request buffering, FREB, trace logs. You can also search, edit, export, and import IIS and ASP.NET configuration data. The tool is built to allow flexible searches for supported server objects. When performing a search, you can use any number of conditions on any of the object's properties, including numeric ranges and simple wildcard string matching. Apt-command also supports linked operations, like those found in Windows PowerShell, allowing multiple operations on a related set of objects to be performed together. For example, you can recycle all application pools that host applications for a certain site in a single command. In IIS 7, the version of ASP.NET that your web application uses is specified in the application pool to which it is mapped. This change in philosophy prevents the problems that occur today when multiple websites running on different versions of the .NET framework are mapped to the same application pool. By default, a new application pool is created when a new site is created in the IIS manager. In addition, it will inject a unique SID which resolves that app pool name into the network service token, the default app pool identity, and create a special apppool.config file for the worker processes to use, and ACL it to only allow that app pool SID to access it. This means that by default, the application pool is isolated from all other application pools on the server from a configuration and from a runtime identity perspective. Sandboxing sites and applications is now as easily as ACLing the content to a unique set of users you want to provide access to, including anonymous user. A small percentage of ASP.NET applications that have runtime incompatibilities with the integrated mode may have to be moved to an application pool running in classic mode. In this case, you can run multiple applications in both modes side by side on the same server by placing them in separate application pools. Let's take a look at some of the things you can do to improve application performance. Remember to follow the best practices and benchmark before and after each change. Consider enabling HTTP compression. HTTP compression compresses response data on the fly to maximize the web server's data throughput. This means less bandwidth usage by the server and improved responsiveness. IIS 7 has static compression enabled by default, so no settings are required. Dynamic compression can also be enabled quite easily. When the CPU of your server is not heavily loaded, the simplest compression strategy is to enable static and dynamic compression for all of the sites and site elements, directories and files, on the server. This is known as global HTTP compression. However, when the CPU load of your server is high, you might not want to enable compression for all of the sites and site elements on the server. Work with the web designers and or content developer to trim content. Clean images and reduce the file size as much as possible. Use higher compression or an alternate format. Also, consider image clustering to combine images and reduce network round trips. Remove white space and unneeded comments from your content to reduce the overall data transfer. Combine CSS, JS, and other static content into a single file to limit the number of network round trips between the client and server. Work with the application developer to streamline the data transfer between client and server. Minimize round trips between the client and server to less than 10 if possible. Minimize the amount of data transfer to less than 100K per user action or page load. This will ensure users with low bandwidth and or high latency connections the best chance of having an acceptable page load time and response time. Limit and page data to the client on query requests. For example, 10 records at a time versus 1,000 records at once. Limit the number of methods called to a web service to 3 or less per user action. Each web service method will generate a minimum of 2 network round trips, usually 3 if Windows integrated authorization is used. Turn off or disable tracing and debug in the web.config file. Also, verify tracing is disabled at the page directive level. View state is used primarily by server controls to retain state only on pages that post data back to themselves. The information is passed to the client and read back in a specific hidden variable called view state. ASP.NET makes it easy to store any types that are serializable in view state. However, this capability can be easily misused, resulting in reduced performance. View state is an unnecessary overhead for pages that do not need it. As the view state grows larger, it affects performance. Increased CPU cycles are required to serialize and to deserialize the view state. Pages take longer to download because they are larger. Very large view state can impact the efficiency of garbage collection. Transmitting a huge amount of view state can significantly affect application performance. The change in performance becomes more marked when your web clients use slow, high-latency connections. Consider testing for different bandwidth conditions when you work with view state. Disable view state if you do not need it. Minimize the number of objects you store in view state. The following list describes key attributes in process model and HTTP runtime in the machine.config file related to ASP.NET Threadpool. If your application makes calls to a remote web service and the requests are waiting for the call to complete, you can increase the CPU utilization and your application performance by changing the max connection attribute on the connection management element in machine.config. Increasing max connection enables more calls to be executed concurrently to a remote web service. This attribute does not affect local web service calls. An increase in the number of concurrent calls causes an increase in the utilization of threads that are used to make the remote calls. Increasing max connection can also lead to an increase in CPU utilization. This increase in CPU utilization is caused by the fact that more incoming requests can be processed by ASP.NET instead of having the incoming requests wait for their turn to call the web service. You need to balance the max connection with the other attributes discussed in this list and the actual CPU utilization. Max worker threads and max I/O threads attributes define the maximum number of worker and I/O threads that the ASP.NET worker process is allowed to create. These values do not reflect the actual number of threads that are created by the worker process. The maximum value for these attributes is 100 per processor. As described earlier, if you increase max connection, you cause increased concurrent processing, which requires a greater number of worker and I/O threads. Consider the following guidelines when tuning these attributes. Change these attributes only if your processor utilization is below the threshold limits defined by your application's performance objectives. Avoid increasing these attributes if the requests are not waiting on an I/O call, but are actually performing CPU-intensive work. Increasing these attributes in this circumstance can negatively affect performance because the already stressed processor now has to handle increased thread context switching. If your application makes a short-running I/O call, for example, to a remote web service, you might not need to increase these values because the calling threads are not blocked for an excessive period. If your application makes a long-running I/O call and your system has idle CPU, you can safely consider increasing these attributes along with the other related attributes discussed in this section. If your system does not have idle CPU, then you probably should not increase these attributes. If you have a web service on the same server as your web application, consider the following to decide when to increase the default values. Increase these attributes only if your processor utilization is below the threshold limits defined by your application's performance objectives. Avoid increasing these attributes if requests are not waiting on an I/O call, but are performing CPU-intensive tasks. Increasing these attributes in this situation can negatively affect performance because the already stressed processor now has to handle increased thread switching. The max connection and min free threads attributes do not have any effect in scenarios where you make any local web service calls. The min free threads attribute defines the number of threads that can be used for work other than processing incoming requests to the worker process. This attribute prevents the ASP.NET process from using a thread from the thread pool to handle a new HTTP request if this would mean that the free thread count drops below this limit. The attribute is specified on the HTTP runtime element and has a default value of 8. You can use this attribute to help prevent deadlocks by ensuring that a thread is available to handle callbacks from pending asynchronous requests. A deadlock can occur if all of the threads in the thread pool are currently in use handling incoming HTTP requests and one or more of those requests is waiting for asynchronous callbacks. In this situation, there are no available threads to service the callback. You can set min-free threads to ensure that some free threads are available to process the callbacks. Increasing min-free threads means that you reserve more threads to make remote calls. In all cases, you should ensure that max worker threads minus min-free threads is greater than or equal to 12. 12 is the optimum number of threads that should be made available to the ASP.NET worker process to service requests. This means that ASP.NET cannot execute more than 12 requests concurrently. This limit is based on a series of performance tests, which demonstrate that normally the worker process uses 4 of these threads. If the processor is fully utilized, greater than 95% utilization, and your application makes long-running calls, the worker process is likely to use all 12 threads. You might want to increase the attribute from the default values when you have increased max worker threads and max I/O threads, or you have increased max connection to a service a greater number of back-end calls, and hence require more threads to be made available for this purpose. You might need to consider changing this attribute whenever you make long-running calls which block your execution. This is most beneficial when the work is not computationally expensive for the server where you make the changes. For a web application using the web service located on the same computer, you should consider decreasing the value of min local request free threads when you need to give priority to processing local calls. This attribute defines the minimum number of free threads that ASP.NET keeps available so that requests from localhost are not queued. Before processing a local request, the runtime checks to see if at least this minimum number of worker threads are available. If fewer threads are available, the request is queued. The default setting is 4, so if only 3 worker threads are available, the local request is queued. When this value is decreased, ASP.NET starts to use threads more aggressively, resulting in less local queuing. Note, requests from remote clients start to queue when the free threads in the thread pool fall below the value of min free threads. If you decrease the min local request free threads value without changing the min free threads attribute, you are effectively telling the worker process to give priority to completing calls from the local server. Let's take a look at the improved ASP.NET performance. In this demonstration, we will see how IIS7 improves ASP.NET performance using output caching. We will also set up a server that hosts 100 sites and use NetSH to adjust timeout settings. Web content can be categorized into 2 categories, static content and dynamic content. Static content doesn't change from request to request. The content that gets returned to the web browser is always the same. Examples of static content are HTML files, JPEG, or GIF files. The other end of the spectrum is dynamic content. The response that gets generated for dynamic content changes with every request. Examples are ASP.NET or PHP content. Between these 2 ends of the spectrum lies semi-dynamic content. Imagine a dynamic ASP.NET page that executes a database query. There is no reason to execute this query on every request if the underlying database tables change infrequently. The IIS7 output caching feature is targeted for semi-dynamic content. It allows you to cache static responses for dynamic requests. Tremendous scalability gains can be achieved. We're going to create an ASP.NET 2.0 application that inserts a copyright notice into a JPEG image. First, we'll create a directory to hold the images, and then we'll copy an image into the directory. Next, we'll use the appcommand command to add an application under default website called Pictures. To simplify our demonstration, we've created a batch file containing the command. Let's create a directory to hold the code that will add the copyright. We've already created some code to do this, so let's copy it to the application directory and take a quick look at it. We can see that the code has created a string called message that contains the copyright message. If it detects that the language is German or Spanish, it will change the message string to a localized copyright message. Then it writes out the message in yellow text using Arial size 20 as a bitmap, and then overlays that on the JPEG. Finally, it saves the modified JPEG out to the response stream. Next, we run a batch file that uses the appcommand command to add a handler for JPEG files to the handler section of the configuration file that uses our code. We will also enable directory browsing because we don't have a default document yet. Now let's open Internet Explorer and browse to our pictures directory. Because we've enabled directory browsing, we can see the contents of the directory. Let's try clicking on the JPEG file we copied earlier. IIS is dynamically generating our JPEG with the inserted copyright message. Our browser is set to English, so we get an English message. To test our dynamic content further, let's change the browser language to German. We can do this in the Internet options by adding the German language to our preferences list and then making it our top preference. We can now see that our copyright message shows up in German instead of English. Let's set the language back to English before we close Internet Explorer. Now that we have a copyright handler working, let's run a performance test to see how fast it is. To do this, we'll use the Web Capacity Analysis Tool, WebCat, which is part of the IIS Resource Kit. WebCat needs three configuration files to set up the test. The first is a script, which lists all of the URLs that we want to test. We've already created the file. The second is the distribution file. The distribution file tells WebCat how to distribute the test across the URLs defined in the script. Since we only have one URL, we will simply set the distribution to URL from 1 to 100%. The third is a configuration file that configures the parameters of a particular performance run. We are going to have a warm-up time of 5 seconds, duration of 30 seconds for our test, and a cool-down time of 5 seconds. We will use one machine to simulate 20 clients. Now we'll start the WebCat controller. As soon as all clients are connected, the performance test will start. We only have one client, so we just have to open another command prompt and start the client pointing to the local host. If we wanted to do this with more client machines, we would set numClientMachines in config.cfg to a higher number and connect clients to the controller via the wcclient command by specifying the name of the controller computer. let's take a look at the log file created by the WebCat controller. The numbers in the middle column of the report show the responses per second. This is not a very high number. The code to dynamically insert the copyright message is pretty slow. IIS can do much better. The only thing we have to do is to create a caching policy that puts URLs with the .jpg extension into the cache. We can add the cache policy using the appcommand command. To make it easier, we've set up a batch file. We'll have it cache the response JPEG files for 10 seconds and let IIS know that language is the factor of variation. Let's run the performance test again. We'll first run the controller. Now we'll run our client again and wait for the results. Let's see what our log shows this time. Amazingly, we are now sending nearly 20 times the responses. This is because IIS doesn't have to run the code every time it gets a request for the dynamic content. It keeps the content around for at least 10 seconds, and as long as it gets another request for the same language, it will send the cached version. Using the IIS 7 output cache feature for semi-dynamic content can give a website a substantial improvement in performance and throughput capacity. A simple configuration change is enough to take advantage of this feature. Now we're going to set up IIS 7 for hosting hundreds or thousands of websites. We'll use the Microsoft recommended and tested method for shared hosting. First, we need to create some accounts on our domain controller. Each site will be hosted in its own application pool, running as a specific domain account. We're going to use the command line to create 100 accounts in the Contoso domain. These accounts will be named Pool ID 1, Pool ID 2, and so on. We'll also set the passwords to defaults of pool ID, PWD, and the ID number. The for command will repeat the net user add command 100 times, incrementing the counter by 1 each time. We're not going to create accounts for site owners to publish content in this demonstration. But if this was a concern, this would be a good time to create them. In this demo, we're going to assume that the content is getting replicated to our content server from another server. Now let's go to our remote content server. For maximum scalability, we're going to use a file server connected to a storage area network, SAN. First, we need to create a directory to hold the content on the virtual E drive. We'll give administrators access to the root content directory. Notice that we have to enter Y to confirm this command. This is important to remember when we set up batch files later. The next step is to set up 100 directories, one for each site. We've already created a batch file to help us with this. Let's take a quick look. This batch file is designed to run once for each directory that it sets up. The first parameter gives it the site ID that it will use to create the directory and subdirectories. The second parameter specifies the root directory of the content share. We'll need to remember to pass the path of the directory we just created, /content. The batch file will create a directory for each site, as well as subdirectories for the various logs and content. The batch file uses the cackles command to assign access to the pool ID accounts that we created on the domain controller, as well as full access to administrators and access to the weblog directory to the web server machine account. Notice that we're using a yes.txt file to answer the confirmation prop. Let's quickly create that yes.txt file. All we need is a file called yes.txt with a single Y in it. We'll use the for command again to call our batch file 100 times. We'll pass the counter from the for command and the path to our content directory as the command line variables. This will take a few minutes, but it is much faster than creating each one by hand. Because we don't have replications set up for this demonstration, let's create a simple default page for each site. We'll use the for command again and create an ASP.NET page that tells the site name and current time in each site's content directory. Next, we'll create a share pointing to the content root directory. The ACLs on the share allow every user change access. This is not a security issue because the security of this solution is enforced by the file ACLs we set when we created the directories using the batch file. Now we'll switch over to our web server. The next step is to set up our application pools and sites. Like before, we've created a batch file to add each pool and site. Each site will run in its own app pool, running under the accounts that we set up previously on the domain controller. We'll also configure each site to use its designated directory on the remote storage server. Let's use the for command again to run our batch file 100 times. This time, the only parameter we need is the counter. This will take a while to complete. In previous versions of IIS, the anonymous user was used to isolate classic ASP content by using a different anonymous user for each website. Isolation was achieved by preventing ASP scripts from reverting back to the process identity. This was called the impersonation sandbox. In mixed environments where classic ASP, ASP.NET, and PHP are used, the impersonation sandbox is not too helpful anymore. ASP.NET, for example, uses different isolation techniques, trust levels, and always runs as the process identity. To achieve isolation in IIS 7, we simply run application pools under different identities, which provides operating system enforced isolation. This works for ASP, ASP.NET, PHP, and other scripting technologies. We're very close to being able to try our sites. First, we need to add the sites to our host file so we can open them in the browser. We'll use the for command again to start a few of the sites. Let's try the sites 40 through 50. Because we haven't configured the sites completely, we'll get an error here. If we look at Task Manager, we can see that the worker process is running for each of our sites under the correct username for each pool ID. Because we use command line tools, we limited our demonstration to 100 isolated sites. This can be extended to thousands of sites using the script and code samples available at IIS.net. Keep in mind that having thousands of sites installed on a machine doesn't mean all of them get requests at the same time. We tested with the 90-10 rule, assuming that only 10% of the installed sites get requests while 90% of the sites are inactive. The netsh commands for HTTP allow us to view and configure setting values on the HTTP server API component. The netsh HTTP commands are available in Windows Vista and Windows Server 2008 and replace the Windows 2003 resource kit's HTTP CFG EXE tool. Timers exist in the HTTP Server API component to ensure availability and protect against overconsumption. Adjusting timers from default values should be carefully evaluated against a potential denial of service attack. We can decrease the idle connection timeout value so that idle connections are recycled more quickly and free up resources in a high usage scenario. It's currently set to 120 seconds, 2 minutes. Let's set it to 90 seconds. Conversely, if we have slow clients, such as mobile devices that are running into timeout errors, we can increase the value. Let's increase it to 4 minutes. Again, we need to be careful. Values that are too low can cause client errors, and those that are too high can overwork the server resources and make it vulnerable to malicious attacks. So far, we've discussed the new IIS 7 architecture and how to optimize the server and applications. Next, we'll talk about the scenarios in which further optimizations may be needed when other servers are involved in the end-to-end solution. The web server may interact with one or more other servers on the same or different machines. It is just as important to benchmark and tune these servers as well. Let's take a quick look at some common performance considerations for these scenarios. Many web applications rely on SQL Server for data storage and retrieval. Use SQL Profiler to measure any stored procedure or queries taking greater than 1 second to process. Analyze and consider fixing these expensive calls. Perform index tuning early and often to reduce the number of reads and to speed up query execution time. This will also reduce the time spent hitting the disk subsystem. Avoid stored procedure recompiles and limit the number of calls to any server to less than 3 for a particular user action. Also, Make sure calls are not redundant for a given user action. Microsoft Office SharePoint Server also relies on SQL Server and IIS for its underlying operations. Consider performance optimizations that will be applied in those scenarios for SharePoint. In addition, there are some features of SharePoint that can affect performance. For example, features that rely on the Microsoft SharePoint Timer service, such as alerts and usage analysis log processing, can have more of an impact on your server performance than other features. Make sure that the time ranges for SharePoint Timer service jobs are staggered and set to times when website usage is typically low. When you enable antivirus protection, each file on the server that is uploaded or downloaded is scanned for viruses and potentially cleaned if a virus is found. You can minimize the performance impact by setting a quicker timeout for scanning and by allocating more or fewer threads to the process. The HTML viewing service converts files and documents into viewable HTML format. It is recommended that you always use a separate server to host the HTML viewing service so that the viewing service performance does not impact the performance of your web server. Log processing relies on the SharePoint Timer service, so one thing you can do to minimize the performance impact is to schedule log processing for times when you know use of your sites is low. You can also increase the number of log files to improve logging performance, or decrease the number of log files to improve log file processing performance. Daily and weekly alerts do not impact performance heavily, but if you have a large number of immediate alerts being sent, it can slow down your server. This feature also relies on the SharePoint Timer service, so you can specify the times for daily and weekly alerts, and you can set a longer interval for immediate alerts. The default is every 5 minutes, but you may want to extend it to 15 minutes, for example. You can also limit the number of alerts each user can sign up for so that your server is not flooded with alert requests. Also, because alerts are controlled at the virtual server level, you can stagger the time ranges for each virtual server so that not all virtual servers are sending alerts at the same time. For more information on these recommendations and other performance considerations for Microsoft Office SharePoint Server, take a look at the topic Capacity Planning for Windows SharePoint Services in the Windows SharePoint Services Administrator's Guide. There are also some recommendations for improving performance when relying on Active Directory for DNS resolution and account control. AD Test is an Active Directory load generation tool provided in the Windows Server 2008 Resource Kit and available for download from Microsoft.com. It allows you to simulate client transactions on the host server. By varying client load, you could relate the transaction rate to resource utilization on the server and get some idea about the requirements for your environment. By varying your hardware environment or other test parameters, you can gain insight into the performance sensitivities of your particular setup. If the DNS service is overloaded, it may take a long time for name resolution. You can use the DNS perfmon counters to monitor performance. Consider adding additional DNS servers. If policies are taking too long to apply, they may be too large or too complicated. Review policy rules and see if they can be streamlined. Try to limit the number of group policy objects, GPOs. Applications that query Active Directory may be making expensive or inefficient queries that consume resources. Expensive means that the query inspected more than 10,000 objects, and inefficient means the query returned less than 10% of the objects inspected. You can adjust the thresholds in HKLM, System, Current Control Set, Services, NTDS, Parameters, Expensive Search Results Threshold, and Inefficient Search Results Threshold. For more information on Active Directory performance, please consult the Windows Server 2008 Resource Kit available on Microsoft.com. What is a storage area network? SANs are networks of storage devices that are designed to allow data to move more efficiently without adding load to the LAN. One of the ways SANs achieve this is through the use of fiber channel connectivity to provide robust performance. SAN technology allows servers to be physically separate from their storage devices at distances up to 100 kilometers, which is far greater than was previously possible and is highly beneficial for business recovery scenarios. In concept, SANs are similar to LAN architectures, which allow connectivity to many devices through hubs, switches, and even directors for high availability. The main benefit of a SAN is that it virtualizes storage for a number of disparate applications, thereby reducing total cost of ownership, or TCO. In addition, organizations derive significant business benefits from the improved backup and data recovery capabilities that SANs provide. SANs make efficient use of storage capacity by consolidating widely distributed disk space onto fewer storage arrays. SANs deliver a better return on capital invested in storage and servers with their increased flexibility and reduced administrative costs that result from centralization. SAN capacities vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, from gigabytes to hundreds of terabytes. The modular nature of SANs, with storage subsystems and fabric separated and available for incremental development, makes it possible to fine-tune storage in a way that is similar to tuning memory within a server. Components of good performance include appropriately loaded disks, appropriate numbers of spindles, sufficient throughput, the ability to segregate demand. Each of these components can be managed not only in significant volumes, but also individually, which makes it possible to get the best average performance and to provide greater resources where they are required. The performance of SQL Server-based applications is very dependent on the disk architecture of the entire storage subsystem. In environments with high I/O, it is often necessary to include more spindles to meet performance requirements. Storage capacity alone does not guarantee that a storage subsystem can meet an organization's performance requirements. Total I/O throughput requirements based on expected and tested workloads are inputs for planning storage requirements. These requirements can then be used to determine the appropriate cable for the fabric, number of spindles in the storage, and number of port connections to that storage. Performance problems can be avoided by proper identification of performance requirements during the requirements gathering phase and by fulfillment of the requirements in the final storage design by working directly with the vendor. SANs can accommodate changes in performance requirements by incorporating additional switches, ISLs, and higher speed links with minimal impact to production servers. There are some other tools that can help monitor the performance of a solution. In addition to the tools we've already discussed and used in the previous demonstrations, there are a few other tools that can help monitor and diagnose performance issues in IIS 7 and Windows Server 2008. Next, we'll explore some of these tools in more depth and discuss the scenarios where they come into play. Performance Monitor is a simple yet powerful visualization tool for viewing performance data, both in real time and from log files. It enables you to examine performance data in a graph, histogram, or report. We'll talk about how to read data from IIS counters in the next demonstration using Performance Monitor. Network Monitor provides information about the network traffic that flows to and from a computer's network adapter. By capturing and analyzing that information, you can prevent, diagnose, and solve many types of network problems. Network Monitor can be used to monitor and diagnose the performance of IIS, and we'll take a look at that in more depth in the demonstration. The IIS 7 Automatic Failed Request Trace Logging feature enables the server administrator to define error conditions for IIS to look out for. Error conditions can range from slow or hung requests to the familiar status codes IIS sends back during error conditions, like Server 500 error. When configured, if IIS 7 detects one of these error conditions, it will automatically log detailed trace events of everything that happened during the request which led up to the error. This is called Failed Request Event Buffering, or FREB for short. Furthermore, you do not have to turn automatic failed request tracing on for every website and every URL on your server. Instead, you can apply automatic failed request tracing to a specific URL or a specific file request. Not only does this reduce the amount of tracing information that could be logged, but it also ensures that this powerful feature has as little performance impact as possible on your server. Let's take a closer look. In this demonstration, we'll use Network Monitor to view network requests, and then we will set up automatic failed request tracing to look for performance issues. Network Monitor is a network diagnostic tool that monitors local area networks and provides a graphical display of network statistics. Network administrators can use these statistics to perform routine troubleshooting tasks, such as locating a server that is down or that is receiving a disproportionate number of work requests. We must run Network Monitor as administrator to capture traffic. To create a new capture session, we'll click the Create a New Capture tab. This opens a new Capture Workspace tab. Network Monitor can capture network data from any of the network connections on the computer. For example, if the computer has a wired network adapter as well as a wireless network adapter, Network Monitor can be set up to capture network frames on either or both connections. By default, Network Monitor only captures frames that pass the filters in the network adapter. Typically, these will be frames that are either addressed to this specific computer, broadcast, or multicast to a group that an application on the computer has subscribed to. We can set Network Monitor to capture in P mode, also known as promiscuous mode, to capture all traffic that is seen by the adapter. This setting results in a higher load on the adapter computer due to an increase in the number of frames the computer must process. You can run Network Monitor in promiscuous mode on another computer on the LAN to troubleshoot a chatty NIC or other network issue without interfering with the performance of the web server. Filtering is one of the most powerful features of Network Monitor. Using filters, we can capture or display only the frames that meet specific criteria. There are many standard filters included. They are intended to serve as examples to help you understand filtering. Many of them require that you modify values for them to be useful. When we choose a standard filter, the filter is inserted into the filter window. For example, in the IPv sub-any filter, we would need to modify this number to reflect our subnet values. Since we are on a closed network for this demonstration, we don't need to apply a capture filter. Display filters work the same way as capture filters, except that they only filter the display, not the capture. Data that meets the capture filter will still be captured. Now we'll start the capture. Capture is running and waiting for network traffic. Let's create some network traffic and then ping our storage server. Now we'll go back to Network Monitor. Okay, we'll stop the capture and see what we've got. The frame summary window gives us a one line per frame view of the current capture. By default, it includes the frame number, timestamp, source, destination, and a description of the highest level protocol in the frame. Here's an address resolution protocol request. And after we found the other server, we proceeded with our ping. When we're analyzing network frames, it is useful to isolate the traffic into network conversations. The highest level in the tree is all traffic. Let's enable network conversations and run our test again. We can enable the setting on the Tools menu under Options on the Capture tab. Now we'll start the capture, then quickly switch over to the command prompt and ping our storage server again. Let's also try pinging an outside server, like Microsoft.com. Since we don't have an internet connection, our ping will fail. Now, if we go back to Network Monitor, we can see that the nodes under All Traffic can now be expanded. The node for My Traffic shows all frames captured that are addressed to or from one of the network adapters on this computer. Other traffic shows the other traffic picked up by the network card that wasn't addressed to or from us. Because we were capturing in P mode, we see everything going on in the network. If we expand the My Traffic node, we can browse by conversation. Here we can see conversations between our computer and the domain controller grouped together. We can drill down to see more and more specific conversations as they're defined in the protocol parsers. We can also copy the conversation view as a filter. Let's try applying it as a display filter to all traffic. There are many advanced things you can do with Network Monitor that we won't cover here. More information and examples are available on Microsoft.com. In IIS 7, you can enable failed request tracing. You must enable failed request tracing on a per-website basis. Let's select the default website. Let's enable tracing. Now we need to configure the events that get recorded for failed request tracing. We will add a rule. In a real-world configuration, we would want to make the rule match the type of request that failed as closely as possible. On a busy server, this can be very important, as it will limit the number of requests that we will trace. Let's turn on tracing for warnings. We can specify the status codes that we want to trace. Let's enter the server error range. We can also use failed request tracing to trace requests that take a long time. Only events that fail with the specified errors or exceed our specified time taken will be logged. Usually, we'd only care about requests that were taking more than a minute or two. Since we want to see a broad range of tracing, let's set this to 1 second. We can deselect the providers we don't care about and specify the level of detail to be collected. We'll leave the rest of these settings at default. Now let's try to go to our default site. We should get an error. Let's try misspelling the extension. Now we'll take a look at the failed request tracing log directory. Here is the folder for the default site. The failed request log for the request that we have just generated is called fr000001.xml. This is the first trace, and subsequent traces that we create are numbered sequentially. Since the log is in XML format, we could use a number of different XML parsers to view or process the output. To make it easier to view these files, there are standard style sheets for failed request log files that are bundled with IIS. Here is the URL that we misspelled. Here is the error which triggered the log. We can expand the list. If there was more than one error warning, we'd see them all listed here for this request. We can look at the entire request trace and find the exact point of failure. Notice that the time is also shown. This is very helpful for troubleshooting why some requests may take a very long time to respond. Additionally, we can look at the trace in a view optimized for troubleshooting performance. This view automatically sorts by the duration of the trace events so that we can immediately see which events are taking the most time to complete. More than just a web server, Internet Information Services 7 provides a secure, easy-to-manage platform for developing and reliably hosting web applications and services. The new integrated request pipeline and fully componentized architecture make IIS 7 highly customizable and scalable. In addition, significant improvements to the Windows Server 2008 TCP/IP stack speed throughput and provide heightened visibility into performance. Hosting 2, 10, hundreds, or even thousands of websites on a single machine is a big challenge. Hosters usually struggle with quality of service, site density, security, and performance problems. IIS 7 makes big strides in all of these areas to provide a first-class experience for hosting customers and hosters. By taking advantage of underlying events now exposed through APIs, monitoring the web server can expose more granular opportunities for improvement. In addition, administrators can proactively catch unforeseen or exceptional behavior and hidden performance bottlenecks by taking advantage of automatic failed event tracing. To get more information on the products and technologies we have covered today, we have some online resources available that can help you. For the most comprehensive technical information about Microsoft products, visit the main TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/TechNet. Additionally, visit www.microsoft.com/TechNet/ITE-300 for more information about books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that relate directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. These include a number of books that can help you better understand performance tuning of your web hosting solution. One of these is Inside Microsoft SQL Server 2005, Query Tuning and Optimization. Understanding the internals of SQL Server helps database developers and administrators to better create, access, and effectively process information from enterprise data. Written by experts on SQL Server, this volume from the Inside Microsoft SQL Server series of books focuses on query tuning and optimization. You'll take an in-depth look at the best ways to make queries more efficient and effective while maximizing existing resources. The shift from standalone desktop applications to web-enabled applications that accommodate hundreds of thousands of simultaneous users makes performance testing critical. Find out how to make your Microsoft.NET-based applications perform as well as or better than traditional desktop applications with this book, Performance Testing Microsoft.NET Web Applications, written by the Microsoft team that tests and tunes hundreds of websites and web-based applications. Get a jump on evaluating Windows Server 2008 with technical insights from the Windows Server team in introducing Windows Server 2008. This practical introduction delivers real-world implementation scenarios and pragmatic advice for administering Windows Server in the enterprise. There are also a number of good books available from other publishers. Professional IIS 7, published by ROCCS, is a complete reference to IIS 7 for both developers and administrators. In addition to covering the common administrative tasks, this book will take an in-depth look at IIS 7 extensibility and operations management. IIS 7 Implementation and Administration, published by Cybex, is designed to ease the learning curve for experienced system administrators and IT professionals, helping them work with developers using the new tools of IIS 7. It concentrates on the crucial skills needed to get up and running quickly with a new product. This book begins by explaining the new interface and basic IIS configuration, and then moves on to ASP.NET configuration. Readers will come to understand the new security model and learn how to work with developers to improve application performance. How to Cheat at IIS 7 Server Administration, published by Syngress, will help administrators migrating from IIS 6 to get up to speed fast on the new version. IIS 7 is the perfect product for the How to Cheat series. How to Cheat promises help getting IIS 7 up and running as quickly and safely as possible. Professional IIS 7 and ASP.NET 2.0 Integrated Programming, published by ROCCS, explores the deep integration of the ASP.NET 2.0 with the IIS 7. It provides ASP.NET 2.0 developers with new exciting programming tools, techniques, and approaches that were not available before. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, which includes e-learning, MS Pressbooks, workshops, clinics, and Microsoft Skills Assessment. This curriculum is offered in instructor-led environments. It offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals in supporting and implementing solutions using Microsoft products and technologies. The course that best supports this session is 6045, which covers administering IIS 7 web servers and is available as an online course. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There is also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills for implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The skills assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which has links to Microsoft official curriculum, specific technical articles, Microsoft Pressbooks, and other Microsoft learning content. There is also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including Security and Patch Management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and Visual Studio.NET. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, A number of certification programs are available. In the highly competitive IT job market, how can you differentiate yourself from the next candidate? The Microsoft certification program provides that edge. Earning specific accreditation provides objective validation of the ability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. There are a number of accreditations available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional, MCP. You can choose to become a fully certified system administrator, MCSA, or system engineer, MCSE, or a desktop specialist, MCDST. The new Microsoft Certified Technology Specialist, MCTS, and Microsoft Certified IT Professional, MCITP credentials provide IT professionals with a simpler and more targeted framework to showcase their technical skills in addition to the skills that are required for specific job roles. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which you may find interesting. To help explain this further, here's Ian Brackenbury, TechNet Subscriptions Product Manager.
TechNet Plus is an essential, premium, web-enabled, and live support resource that provides IT professionals with fast and easy access to Microsoft experts, software, and technical information, enhancing IT productivity, control, and planning. With convenient access to all these resources in one online location, TechNet Plus provides you with what you need to help you evaluate products and learn new skills, plan for and deploy new technologies, and support and maintain your IT environment. For evaluation and learning, you get access to all Microsoft full-version software for evaluation without time limits. This includes Microsoft Server, client, and application software titles. With full-version software, you can make informed decisions about new technologies at your own pace. You also receive access to the latest betas before public release. Be the first to try out the latest pre-release versions of Microsoft operating systems, servers, and business applications. TechNet Plus also offers quarterly training resources, including select Microsoft e-learning courses for free, so you can keep your skills current, prepare for a certification exam, or get ready for a specific project. For planning and deployment, the TechNet Library includes resources to help you plan for and deploy new technologies in your IT environment, including a complete knowledge base, resource kits, utilities, and technical training. You also get exclusive tools like System Center Capacity Planner to accurately plan for and deploy Exchange Server and System Center Operations Manager. And to stay informed, your subscription also includes a free subscription to TechNet Magazine, the Microsoft Journal for IT Professionals. For support and maintenance, TechNet Plus comes with two complimentary professional support incidents. You can talk to a Microsoft support professional to quickly resolve your mission-critical technical issues fast. TechNet Plus also provides access to over 100 managed news groups. You can exchange ideas with other professionals and get expert answers to your technical questions within the next business day, guaranteed. You also get access to TechNet Library resources to help you support and maintain your IT environment, including security updates and service packs. TechNet Plus offers proven value that far exceeds its cost. The two complimentary professional support incidents alone more than offset the cost of a TechNet Plus subscription. Add to that the evaluation software and beta software and other technical resources, and TechNet Plus clearly boosts productivity. Every IT professional on the team needs one. For more information or to purchase a TechNet Plus subscription, please visit technet.microsoft.com/subscriptions.